It seems like interest in using native plants in home gardens just continues to grow. And it's no surprise, really, since they have a lot of qualities to recommend them. This summer, with the drought conditions, we were able to see how they do in those extreme situations. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Neil DeBull from Prairie Nursery comes by a few times a year to talk about how to use native plants and why you should appreciate them. Neil, always great to have you with us.
Thank you, Judith. Great to be here.
It's always a pleasure. And I know I always learn a lot, and I'm sure our listeners do too. And I want to make sure that they know how they can join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, comment, or we love to see pictures of your native plants and gardens at our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. I find that Larry doesn't think about spelling it because it's his name. So, and sometimes we get people asking, I can't find you. Well, it's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Well, Neil, so much to talk about, as always. And certainly, between yesterday and today, we've had a huge change in temperature. So it's actually feeling like winter now. But let's cast our memories back to that amazingly hot and dry summer that we had. You know, it really gave us a chance, one we really didn't want to have, but, you know, got to make lemonade out of the lemons, right? It gave us a chance to see how different plants did with those drought conditions. What did you see with native plants?
You know, it was really fascinating. In the final analysis, the drought of 2012 affected our native plants, in most cases, more deleteriously than the 1988 drought.
Really?
Yes.
Why do you think that was the case?
I think because in 1988 we got some rain. Most people got rain in late June, and we had some more rain in July. This year, the drought in most parts of southern Wisconsin was relentless. And you not only had the drought, but you had a period of very, very high temperatures, 105, 106, depending where you were, with high winds, which desiccated the plants.
Mm.
And
it was like they were in a convection oven, basically.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was in a convection oven. I hated it. I hate hot weather. Yeah. I moved to Wisconsin from Missouri to get away from this, and here I am in the middle of it, like, oh, my God. But what was fascinating to me was in the drought of 1988, the prairie grasses, especially some of them, especially the short grasses, went dormant, where their leaves turn kind of a bluish gray, and there's no moisture in them. You step on the grasses, and they literally crunch under your feet like it's wintertime. And then when it rained, literally overnight, they rehydrated, turned green, and it was like nothing ever happened.
And dormancy is a natural response to a drought, right?
Precisely. The prairie plants, I mean, they're accustomed to this. They've had to evolve over thousands of years with this. The tall prairie grasses, like big blue stem, switchgrass, they did not go dormant in 1988. They stayed green. Okay, they were affected. Their growth rates were reduced, but they stayed green. This year, not only did the short grasses go dormant, many of them abandoned leaves. I mean, they went brown.
Wow.
Okay, little blue stem, some of the plants, 50% of the plants just turned brown. They have completely said, forget it. Big blue stem, which did not go dormant in 1988, some of those plants abandoned some individual clumps up to 90% of their leaves. Were abandoned. They just said, forget it, we're going dormant, we'll come back next year when conditions are better. I'd never seen anything like that.
Wow. So this year really was just unprecedented.
And in my lifetime, I mean, I think you have to go back to 1936. You know, we did break the July average temperature, daily temperature, from 1936, which is the ultimate record that nobody ever thought would be broken.
Wow.
We broke it by 0.2 degrees Fahrenheit, so it wasn't that much. But it was a huge, huge record to break, and then that's how hot our July was. And so you combine that with a lack of rainfall, you have a really, in my lifetime, unprecedented drought. And the plants really showed it. Whereas, however, a lot of the prairie plants just said, huh, who cares? You know, some of them were completely and utterly unaffected.
Well, and my understanding is that a lot of native plants have such a deep and extensive root system that the parts of the plants that are actually bringing in the water and things, they might not even have known that there was a drought going on up there.
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the prairie flowers have roots 10, 15, even 20 feet.
That's amazing. Wow.
So when you get really dry weather like this, they're like, no big deal, we can get moisture. And those plants generally did fine. There were some plants, however, that were just, I was shocked by some of the more shallow-rooted plants like showy goldenrod, which grows in these really super dry, sandy prairies in central Wisconsin. even the tips of the leaves never even browned. Nothing, absolutely nothing happened. They bloomed floriferously throughout this intense heat and lack of moisture. And I would not have expected that plant to have survived with, not only survived, but prospered under these conditions. It shows that every plant has its own strategy, its own abilities to live under these difficult conditions.
And it shows why some of those, like the showy goldenrod, are still with us, because I'm sure they've gone through, this wasn't the first time that that species has survived and figured out how to flourish.
Yeah, these guys have been around a long time.
That's amazing.
They know what to do. But even the plants that were affected negatively, they just go dormant and say, heck with it, I'll come back next year.
So do you expect, do you expect things to come back pretty much as they would under normal conditions next year?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, 1988 showed us that, and history shows us that. Here's a fascinating study that was done during the drought of the 30s in Nebraska, and mostly in Nebraska and western Iowa, by a professor, John Weaver, at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He studied the prairies during the drought of the 30s, and he would sample these prairies from year after year after year, and he would look at the vegetation. And what happened during the extreme drought of the 30s is the major dominant prairie grasses and flowers, mostly, with some exceptions, a lot of them just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the rains came 6 years later, 7 years later, he's out sampling these, and here comes some of the plants he hasn't seen for 6 years. Big bluestem, purple prairie clover, plants that have been gone from his studies for 6 years, 7 years. Suddenly, they're back, and they were not seedlings. They were from dormant roots.
Wow.
That had been dormant.
They'd just been waiting.
7 years. They just sat there and waited for the weather to change.
Wow.
Now, in his studies, he says they were not in the best of shape, but they were alive, and they came back, and they recovered, and they regrew. So, I mean, that tells you something right there. Pretty amazing.
Well, and it's interesting that Ken Burns' Dust Bowl documentary was just on. I have to say, I'm sure he was in the late stages of editing during the drought this summer. He was probably thinking, wow, this is pretty good advertising for my next documentary. I mean, you know, my understanding, I have them recorded, but I haven't watched them yet. My understanding is that a lot of what contributed, I mean, obviously there were the meteorological issues, but a lot of what contributed to the impact on human beings was that a lot of those prairie plants and grasses had been taken out, and those strong root systems were what was holding the Midwest where it was. And without that.
Absolutely. If it had not been plowed up for wheat, you never would have had a Dust Bowl.
Yeah,
because you had the buffalo grass and the blue gramma grasses, all these grasses, and some of the flowers out there holding that soil in place, like they did for thousands of years. And the old timers, because this was ranching country, and they grazed cattle out there, and the ranchers told them they're crazy. This land is going to blow away, and they wouldn't listen because they were getting $2, $3, $4 a bushel for wheat in 1917, 1920, these huge prices. People were getting super rich, and they just plowed it up. And when the winds came and the drought came, it was all over.
Wow. We're talking with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery, talking about native plants, prairies, meadows, woodlands, grasses, all kinds of fascinating topics. We'd love to have you join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Andrea in Hollandale. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, good morning. Neil, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I have had a no-mow lawn in for about 10 years for about an acre, and it's been fantastic. So if anyone's considering a no-mow lawn, take it from me. Very low maintenance, absolutely beautiful. I have to say, though, this summer was really brutal on it.
It was really brutal on a lot of lawns. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Now, I'm doing a 20-acre prairie restoration, and my bigger grasses and forbs and things did okay. Mm-hmm. They did get a little crunchy, but with the rain, they seemed to spring back. But now I'm wondering what you would recommend that we do for our no-mow, because not only did we have, you know, open full sun and desiccating winds for weeks, we also had a lot of moles.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. So it's pretty much in a lot of sections, it's going to be starting over. And I'm considering going to short grasses and forbs instead of no-mow. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe give me a little bit of pro and con of either one.
Sure. And, you know, the no-mow, which is our blend of six different fine fescues, has a really deep root system, normally gets about a foot deep. And this is the first time, and I work with these plants for over 20 years, the no-mow lawn. And this is the first year we've seen losses due to drought. It is one of the most drought-tolerant turf grasses there is, but this year just hammered it. And the problem with the fine fescues is if they go into serious dormancy in a drought, oftentimes they don't come back, and that's what we're seeing. So in that case, you really have to either replant it to the NOMO and hope you don't have another one of these droughts for 30 years, or, like you say, put it into short prairie grasses and flowers. And that's a really good option, especially in an area where you don't necessarily need a lawn, like you're not going to play croquet or baseball or football. You can convert it to a prairie, and not only do you get the benefits of the super drought-tolerant prairie plants, you get the flower, the color of the flowers, the use by, of the flowers by the pollinators, the seeds are used by the birds, insects are eaten by the birds, and of course then you get those beautiful prairie grasses in the fall and the winter. So I guess in your situation, if I didn't need a lawn, I'd probably consider putting it into prairie also.
Yeah, that's kind of where we're going. We also don't want to irrigate because we're in a well.
So, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's, I think the prairie is the way to go, and boy, you can't get prettier plants than what's in your catalog. So,
well, thank you. And you know, the prairie is this year I have about an acre prairie in front of my house, and I said I am not watering this thing. I'm going to see what happens.
Wow.
Because this is, I mean, how many chances do you get to watch these plants
yep.
under these conditions? And my front yard is basically rock with a little soil mixed in, so it is a brutal, brutal environment, full sun. And you go out there with a shovel, you go down about an inch and you hit rock. Now, it's fractured dolomite, so there's soil mixed in there, mm-hmm. but it's pretty tough. I was astounded at how the plants hung in there. And some of the plants, say, for instance, like the nodding pink onion, which normally blooms in mid-July. It has waxy leaves. It just sat there during the drought. It didn't brown. It didn't die. It didn't go dormant. It just sat there. And then it rained in August, and it bloomed in August instead of July. And a lot of the plants did that this year. They just kind of hung in there, waited for their chance. And then, hey, July was no good, but August is okay.
So it looks like instead of kind of going by their usual internal clock, they were waiting for the conditions that generally are favorable for flowering.
Yeah. So they just kind of hung in there and waited for the weather to improve.
Because flowering is a big effort on their part, right?
Huge.
So they need, you know, whatever nutrients and moisture, and certainly they weren't lacking in sun, but, you know, all the other things. That's really interesting. So clocks were completely thrown off.
Yeah, a lot of them. Yeah. And they just kind of said, okay, we'll wait till it's better. And that's what a lot of the plants did. And they just came in a little bit later. And, of course, we had a pretty late fall as we're having more and more. So they were fine. They made their seeds and went on their way. And they'll be back next year, too.
Wow. Well, thanks for that call, Andrea. And it's always nice to hear people reporting on actually having a prairie and using the no-mow grasses and things like that. And, you know, it's no surprise that obviously the drought affected everything. But I think a lot of it is the lasting effects. And it sounds like you expect the prairie plants to come back pretty well.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if you actually had any mortality of these plants. Mm-hmm. The exception to that would be sometimes in gardens, we like to push the limits. And so we'll put a plant that grows in a wetland into an upland situation. Oh my God, I'm so busy watering. I forgot to water that area, or I didn't have a chance to water that area, or I was afraid my well would run dry. So the plants that you're putting in a marginal situation that would normally need more moisture mm-hmm. or maybe needs more shade.
Right.
Okay. When you put it in a sunny hot spot and you can't water it, those plants might run the risk of perishing. But hey, I'm amazed at what these plants can do. I'm absolutely astounded at their flexibility and their ability to survive even under, you know, really serious stress.
Neil DeBull from Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, with us today for Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about prairies, meadows, woodlands with Neil DeBull. He is at Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, and he comes by a few times a year to talk about native plantings and to give us all advice. And Neil, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Judith.
It's always lots of fun. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amanda Magnus, our on-air producer today, happy to take your calls and also your emails. You can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Or, as always, go to our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And you do not need to be a member of Facebook to see things that we post. You can go there. And we love to see photos of people's native plants and gardens and meadows and all kinds of great things. Now, as we said, it's feeling very wintry all of a sudden, but is there still time to do some fall maintenance on our prairie and woodland gardens, Neil, or is the season really over at this point?
Well, it depends how hardy you are, I guess. can you garden down to 20 below? Or...
Yeah.
But no, there's a lot of things you can do right now. For instance, I have been lazy, and what I like to do with my woodland gardens is I go and rake my leaves, mm-hmm. and I pile them on my woodland gardens about 6 inches deep.
Oh, okay.
Okay, which is great for the woodland garden because, number one, the leaves provide nutrients as they break down for the plants. And by putting leaves on, leaves basically have no weeds in them.
Oh, that's so, a great, yeah. So it's a great insulation without adding any, bad guys.
And it's free. Just takes a little effort. And then the leaves, of course, they'll pack down over the winter. So the 6 inches becomes maybe 2 inches or mm-hmm. 3 inches. And by covering the soil, you don't have any weeds. So you smother the weed seeds that would germinate. So it creates about as low maintenance a woodland garden as you can get. And you're feeding your plants in the same process. All you have to do is go lick the dog on leaves.
Which you're probably going to do anyway.
Well, what I do is these people in town, it's a little bit late now, but all these wonderful people in town, they bag their leaves up for me. I just drive by and throw them in my car. It's like, this is great. Just make, it's just like
so that's why they call you the crazy leaf guy.
That's right. Absolutely. And they go to pick up all the leaves in town, and it's like, wow, thank you. This is so nice. And just drag them out to the garden and cover them. It's like, it's a lot easier than raking your own leaves.
But make sure there are no black walnuts in there.
Oh, very good point. Although a lot of native plants.
That's true. We were talking about that.
Yeah, a lot of the native wildflowers are quite tolerant of black walnut. But yeah, I always look at the leaves of the trees species in the yards. Okay, and you always want to go for sugar maple, ash, things like that. These have the sweet leaves, basswood. Hmm. They have what we call sweet leaves.
Which means what?
Means their pH is around 7. Okay, and they tend to be high in calcium, magnesium, nice nutrients.
So they're not too acidic, basically.
Exactly. And the oak leaves they have high tannin levels. They tend to be acidic. They take longer to break down. Hey, I have mostly oaks on my property, so when I rake my leaves, I get oak leaves, but they don't do as good a job. They're not as nice, and they don't add as much nutrients.
What about pine needles?
Well, you know, in the South, a lot of people use pine needles for mulch, and they have a big business where people go out into pine plantations and rake up the needles and bag them up and sell them.
And then people like you drive by.
No, they sell them. I have friends that come over to my pines. We have a little plantation that was planted 60 years ago. And they come and they will rake up the pine needles. I don't use pine needles because they tend to be acidic. And I don't really, and a lot of people like the looks of them. I don't really care. So, but you want to be careful that you don't over acidify your soil, especially if you're on a soil that is easily acidified, particularly sandy soils. But on our southern Wisconsin soils, most of them are fairly alkaline or circumneutral, so you can use pine needles without really
it won't throw
them,
it
generally speaking, unless you just pile it on so thickly. But there's such a buffering capacity in most of our soils because they're formed from the breakdown of limestone and dolomite, which tend to have a high calcium, high lime level.
And you also mentioned that this time of year and even later into the winter, controlling woody invasives, this is a great time to do that.
Oh, yeah. This is a great time. After all the leaves have fallen off, let's say you have a problem with buckthorn or honeysuckle. These are the two most common ones. Box elder, black locust can be highly invasive. What I do is this is the time of year when I go out and kill that stuff. And the leaves have fallen off, so you don't have to wrestle the plants with all the leaves on them when you cut them down. And the plants also withdraw a lot of the nutrients from the plant as they go dormant. And so the wood is actually lighter because they take the moisture and the nutrients out of it. And you can cut them at the base, at the ground level, when the trees are dormant. And then you apply, I just use regular concentrated Roundup. And you put it on the cambium, which is the first half inch inside the bark.
Okay.
The rest of the tree or the shrub is basically dead in the middle, so it doesn't pay to put any herbicide on that. So immediately after you cut it down, you apply undiluted, like 40% glyphosate Roundup, and that will go down in the root and kill a plant, and you'll never have to deal with it again.
So basically that little layer there will absorb that and draw it down right where you want it
to. Exactly. And the time to do this is fall and winter. It doesn't work in spring because the energy of the plant is coming up in the winter. Mm-hmm. It just forces the herbicide up, doesn't do anything, and the plant will resprout. And now you've got 10 resprouts instead of one stem, which is, I learned this the hard way, of course. How do you learn to do something? You mess it up the first time.
Right.
So.
Not that I've ever done that, of course.
No. So cutting in the fall and the winter is the best.
And so it's, and there are a lot of other things that this isn't the best time to do. So it's nice that there is something that. This is the window of opportunity.
Yeah. And if you get a calm day, maybe it's 30-something degrees outside. I go out there until it's like, you know, Roundup freezes at like 25, and it starts to get slushy.
And so do you.
And you got to go in. Yeah, right, exactly.
We're talking with Neil DeVol of Prairie Nursery in Westfield. He is an expert on prairie plants, meadows, native plants of all types, and we'd love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. And Steve in New Berlin is up. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. We are about 3.5 months into a building project in Iron County on lakefront property. We tore the old cabin down, and it's on a hill, and all of the vegetation that used to be around the old cabin is destroyed in the excavation. And so come spring, we're going to have to do some planting. It's very rocky, rocks and gravel. And Neil talked about his property where a shovel will go down about an inch. That's about what this is like. And we have to, replant all around the cabin in the spring.
Sure.
And if we don't do something right away, there'll be a lot of erosion because we are on a hill. So what should we put in?
Let me ask you a couple questions.
Yes. Okay,
what direction does your slope face, north, south, east, or west?
West. The lake, and that's also the lakeside.
Okay, and does it get full sun, part sun?
Well, it gets, we took down 11 trees in order to build, so there's probably quite a bit of sun all around the cabin now.
Okay, and how do you want to use this area? Do you want to be able to walk on it? Does it not matter if you have access to it?
Well, this is the area immediately around the new building.
Okay, so you probably don't want a prairie right up to the building.
Well, we want to be able to walk on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll tell you what. I would suggest that you try our No-Mo Lawn Mix, which grows on my rock. I use it for my trails on my woodland edges, and it grows right on this little bit of soil on the rock. And it was, I would tell you, at my house, I had no issues. The only place I lost my No-Mo was on one really dry, dry, sandy spot, and another spot where I had seeded some last fall. And the roots were not deep enough.
So it wasn't established.
It wasn't established. The roots were not deep. And that, I completely lost all of that because the roots were only a few inches deep. But the No-Mo has the ability to grow in very dry, rocky, gravelly soils. However, what I would recommend that you do before you do anything, are you going to be up there again before the end of the year, before the ground freezes?
Oh, I go up. Well, I think the ground's frozen. But I go up there about every 10 days to check on the progress.
Okay. I suggest that you do a soil test.
Okay.
And send that in to, the state soil lab in Madison or in Marshfield. And I think if you just Google Wisconsin State Soil Testing Lab, you'll see that. And they will do a test for you. And what you want to look for, just tell them it's for turf. And oftentimes when I'm particularly on sandy soils, I will look for micronutrients. The normal test only checks phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, and pH. And these are very important. These are your macronutrients, and the pH will determine the availability of other nutrients. But sometimes on really poor soils, you want to look at micronutrients. Sometimes you might be low in sulfur or iron or boron. Manganese can be a problem. So get the micronutrient test. It's $10 more, but it can make a huge difference. And so test your soil before you plant anything. And then if you decide to go with the No-Mo, plant that first thing in spring because you want to get it established before weeds start germinating in spring. If you had an option, the best time to plant the No-Mo is in fall. But you can have very good results by planting it in early spring. The problem is spring plantings always have more weeds than fall plantings because most of your weed seeds germinate in the spring and early summer. Whereas in the fall, you get very few weed seeds germinating. But
They're going to come back and do final grading in the spring. So after that, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wait until it's all final graded. And if it's on a steep slope, I would suggest that you put down an erosion blanket, which you stake in with these metal stakes, six-inch long metal stakes, to hold everything in place, unless your soil is so rocky that there's no chance of erosion. Sometimes on your really rocky soil, it is so porous that when it rains hard, the soil doesn't puddle and you don't actually get any erosion.
Yeah, the soil is so rocky that when they did the backfilling around the foundation, they brought in a sandy mix to put in around the foundation because the existing soil was too rocky and too many boulders to actually put in on the foundation.
Is there some soil mixed in with these rocks?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good. So it's not just pure rock.
Right.
Okay.
It's sandy and gravelly.
Yep.
And
that's right. That's right where the No-Mo will grow. And up in Iron County, you have cooler weather, too, so that helps a lot.
Yeah. Is there... I wouldn't want to plant any seed now, right?
Oh, no. No, you have to wait till it's final graded next spring.
Okay.
Yeah. Wait till they're done with all the grading, and hopefully that will be early in spring. And get it seeded immediately after that. But I do suggest you get your soil tested this fall so you'll be ready for spring in case you need to amend the soil with anything.
Thanks for that call, Steve, and good luck with that. And I wanted to point out that Ed posted on our Facebook page, Think Spring, Dutchman's Breeches, or Breeches, as in Genoa City. And Dutchman's Breeches are such a lovely spring flower, aren't they?
I love them, yes. They're very much a spring ephemeral. They tend to grow on hillsides with good drainage, and they are one of the first of our wildflowers to bloom and one of the first ones to go dormant. They're usually dormant usually by sometime in June, but when they're in bloom, they are absolutely gorgeous.
Great. Thanks for that photo. And yeah, about this time of year, it's pretty tempting to start thinking about the spring. And we're definitely going to talk about how to plan our native plantings for the spring. But let's go to a couple more calls first. Ellen in Madison is next. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I just moved to a condo committee in the summer, and our lawns took a real hit. So some of us have been talking about switching from all the lawns to some kind of ground cover. I'm thinking prairie, but it's going to be a hard sell to convince people who love their lawns. So is there anything we could say to get people to accept the idea, and anything that we can do to make things look instantly beautiful and not have the prairie look ragged? I like the prairie look, but I think a lot of the people here won't.
You know, there's two ways to do this. If you look at
the easy way and the hard way.
There's four ways to do this.
Least expensive.
Oh, gosh. Well, if you look at how you can use native plants, let's just take prairies, for instance, in a landscape situation, you basically have two different ways to do it. One is to create a garden, which is really no different from a perennial garden. You're just using native prairie flowers and grasses. And you can design it. You put the plants where you want them so they're associated with one another. You get your different colors and textures together. It's a lot of fun designing a prairie garden. But that's usually for small areas. Mm-hmm. Let's say you have a larger area, like a quarter acre or half an acre or even just, you know, a few thousand square feet. If you're going to spend, you know, $3 a plant and you got 5,000 square feet and you're putting in about one plant per square foot, well, that's $15,000 just to do 5,000 square feet. That gets kind of
right.
Nice.
Yes, that's our problem.
So that's where we go to seed. But when you use seed, you have less control. Mm-hmm. You're putting a seed mix down, and the plants are going to sort themselves out. And because these are perennials, it's going to take 3 to 5 years for the seeds to turn into flowers and grasses that really are mature and blooming and looking good. And in the first 2 years, it looks like a big weed patch, and most Americans, being impatient as they are, say, wow, it's going to take forever. Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly.
This looks terrible. Cut it down. Get rid of it. You know. And so we always, when we're dealing with clients who are maybe not as familiar with prairies, most of our clients, they understand the process.
If they end up at your place, they've got some familiarity.
Most
probably.
People know. Yeah. I mean, it used to be that 20 years ago, this is really weird. When I started doing this 30 years ago, it was really, really weird. Mm-hmm. Okay, but now people understand it and they accept it, and they are willing to wait that time period. But a lot of times when people who are not familiar with it, or you're trying to pitch it to somebody who's never done it, I tell them 3 to 5 years. Don't scream at me until 3 years. If it's not looking good by August of the third year, then you can scream at me. But leave me alone for the first 2 years. Okay? But the thing about seeds is that you don't have the control of where the plants are. What I like to do is I like to create different seed mixes with different themes. So mm-hmm. use different grasses and different flowers in different areas so it's not all the same. And then you can paint with the flowers. You can take some of the flowers and put a drift here or a patch there so it looks more like nature. So you can kind of do some quote-unquote gardening effects with the seeds by how you place them. But it's extremely important that wherever you go, you want to have a solid cover of prairie grass, because it's the grasses and the deep roots and the fibrous roots of the grasses that help to cut to squeeze out the weeds. So put the grasses in, and then you can paint with the flowers. And as long as the people are willing to wait 3 to 5 years, you're good to go.
Okay, great. Or, you know, I was thinking maybe we could just do little trial areas, like we have in some areas where we just, you know, take a couple of common spaces and say, all right, these are going to be our prairies. Let's see how they do.
That's a really good idea. Yeah, and that's what a lot of our customers do, is they have an acre. They can't do it all in 1 year. Okay, we'll do a test area here. Mm-hmm. We'll get used to it. We'll learn about it, understand it. And then when they go to do a larger area, they've got the experience. They know what to expect. It's not a big surprise.
Well, and Ellen, also, I wonder if kind of pitching it to your neighbors as, let's plant a butterfly garden.
Oh, I love that.
You know, and they might get excited about that, thinking about what kind of habitat it's going to turn into, and you don't have to, you don't have to go into the nitty gritty of, these are native plants and blah, blah, blah. You could just say, we're going to design something to attract butterflies and hummingbirds and all
exactly.
kinds of things.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And you know,
that would be good.
We have pre-designed butterfly gardens, bird gardens, hummingbird gardens that use transplants. And then we have butterfly meadows, which are prairie seed mixes, specifically designed to attract butterflies.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. That is good. Now, how much maintenance do they require until they get started and then after they're started?
Are you talking about a garden or with plants or a meadow with seeds?
I'm thinking butterfly gardens.
Okay, so where you put in transplants?
Yeah.
Okay, that's really easy. It's like any garden. Number one, whether you're using whether you're using transplants or seeds, the most important thing is to kill all the weeds first. Whether you're going to kill them with Roundup or till them all season long or smother them all year long, you can do it. No chemicals required. Just put down. This is one thing you can do right now. Pick your area, go down and put down your cardboard or your old rugs or whatever and put that down right now and smother it for a year and it'll be ready to go. Well, probably, depending what's growing there, if it's just a lawn, it'll be ready to go by May.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if it's full of weeds, it won't be ready to go till next September. But kill all the weeds. Then you put in your plants. Now, some people don't want to use any chemicals at all. Some people are okay with it. Some people use a pre-emergent after they put their plants in, like preen, to keep weeds from germinating. And then you put mulch over it. If you don't want to use the herbicides, the preen, just put about 3 inches of mulch over the plants. Very few weeds will come up through that. When you're using mulch, I like to use either straw or oats, wheat or oat straw, or you can use the shredded hardwood bark. Do not use the bark nuggets, which usually come from like pine trees or something like that. That will kill a lot of your perennials. So be very careful what you mulch with. Some people use cocoa bean hulls. Some people use rice hulls. Cocoa bean hulls, however, are apparently toxic to dogs.
Well, and they also, I've noticed that they tend to mold a lot.
They do mold, but they smell really good.
They do smell good.
Yes, and they do get moldy. That's why I just like to use straw.
Yeah.
Okay, and you get bales of straw and cover it. And, you know, that's, prairie grasses are close, and flowers are closest to straw. They're not woody. They're not bean hulls. That's what they're made from. So that's the easy, simple way to do it. Get all the weeds killed, put in your plants, and then prevent the weeds, because you do not want to be out there weeding. Take the steps right after you put your plants in, using preen or mulch or a combination of the two. And then the mulch also helps hold the moisture in, so you don't have to water it as much.
Great.
Okay. And you can, if you want, can we give people our...
Sure.
If you want to get our catalog, it has tons of information and gardens and seed mixes. You can, nobody's in the office today, but you can call on Monday at 1-800-476-9453. Or you can just go to our website, and we have a place where you can sign up for a catalog there at www.prairienursery.com. That's PRAIRIENursery.com.
And we have a link to prairienursery.com on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. And also, I would encourage folks to go to the Facebook page and look at the photo that Andrea posted. First of all, thanks for that call, Ellen, and good luck with that. Definitely give us a report on how your convincing goes. Andrea posted a lovely photo that says, thanks to Neil DeBull and Prairie Nursery for awesome prairie plants and no-mow grass. And it's a really nice picture. There's the no-mow grass around it. And then, as you said, Neil, you know, you really can use prairie plants to look like a designed garden, just
Absolutely.
Like any other perennial. Really lovely combination of grasses and high and low perennials. Really lovely. I think
that
showing
nice.
A photo like that would
Beautiful.
Convince anybody that that's the way to go.
And you know, I can design an English garden look using all native prairie plants.
Wow.
And you wouldn't know it was an English garden.
I think people sometimes think of native plants as kind of native equaling wild and that they're just going to be out of control. But there's so many and some really wonderful, delicate, small plants, like those Dutchman's breeches that we're looking at. Those spring ephemerals
Fantastic.
Are lovely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say, you know, look at that picture that Andrea posted, Ellen, and show that to your neighbors. We're talking with Neil DeBull, Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, talking about all things native. And let's go to Brian in Green Bay. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I live in the city of Green Bay. I have a lot with the east side has 14 oak trees along it, and a few years ago we got rid of all the buckthorn, and now we're working on the honeysuckle. But my question is, in the afternoon, it gets a lot of sun along that line, so I don't want to just get rid of all that. You know, we knock down the buckthorn and the honeysuckle went wild. So if I knock down the honeysuckle, I want to actually put something in there to replace it or at least encourage something better to grow there. What
sure.
do you suggest?
Okay, let me ask you this. What's your soil type there, Brian?
Clay.
Clay, okay. And these are mature oak trees along a row of them or a group of them?
Yeah, they're a row. They're 50 feet high approximately.
Okay, so you're getting plenty of sun under those oak trees.
Yes.
Okay. You have a couple choices here. You could go in and put in some native shrubs. Is your goal to have shrubs or flowers or grasses or all of the above?
It would be nice to have some kind of a shrub because there's an awful lot of songbirds that come through on the migration, and
sure.
we have feeders out.
Okay. I suggest that you look at putting in some native shrubs. Some excellent shrubs for birds include ninebark, which does great in clay.
Okay.
And you've got all the viburnums, which are not the best bird food, but it's good cover. But if you're looking at good bird food, you can go with some of the dogwoods. Now, be careful with the dogwoods. There's the red osier dogwood, and the gray, that's pretty well behaved. The gray dogwood will creep and crawl to form big patches. So you want to give that one room to run if you're going to put that in. If you don't want a plant that's going to run, do not put in the gray dogwood. You'll be sorry when you did that. Okay.
Okay.
There's also a plant called black chokeberry, Aronia melanocarpa. Okay. That is a great plant for clay and another pretty darn good bird plant. So those are just a few of the native shrubs mm-hmm. you could look at.
And if I'm remembering correctly, I think when we've had Brian Huddleston on talking about diseases, I think he often recommends the ninebark as being very disease resistant.
It's amazing. It's pretty much a carefree plant. Yeah, it really is. And there's some pretty interesting selections. If a lot of people only want to plant the open pollinated natives, but there's some pretty interesting selections of the ninebark out there, and I can't think of the name. It's like fire. Oh, God, I can't think of it.
They're supposed to be very attractive.
Oh, yeah. They have some really nice golden leaf colors. You can go to a garden center, good woody nurseries, and they'll be able to help you with that. But you also then, here's a little trick if you want to really create habitat, is then put your shrubs kind of mixed in with your line of oaks. And it doesn't have to be linear. You can make groups in there. Then in front of those shrubs, where you have even more sun, you can put in prairie flowers and grasses. Now what you've done is you've created three different habitat types together, the trees, the shrubs, and the prairie. You now are leveraging that ecosystem, if you will, or that small, narrow band. You're taking it from a monodimensional trees only to three different ecosystems, all of which provide different food sources, whether it's the insects from the prairie, the seeds from the prairie, the seeds from the shrubs, the bird nesting sites from the shrubs, the leaves for the caterpillars, for the butterflies, mm-hmm. and oaks are one of the prime food sources for caterpillars.
Oh, wow.
I didn't realize that. Oh, it's unbelievable the number of insects that utilize oak leaves. It's phenomenal. If you read Doug Tallamy's book, Bringing Nature Home, it is astounding what this guy did. He's incredible. And
he's been on the show before.
Yeah, he's amazing. So read Doug Tallamy's book, Bringing Nature Home, and he has these lists of how many different native insect species utilize different genera. Oaks are at the top of the list. So you have an opportunity here to create a wildlife extravaganza in a relatively small area by putting in shrubs and prairie plants together.
I'm excited, Brian. How about you?
Yes, it's already a wildlife extravaganza. They're mostly white oaks, and everything comes to eat those acorns.
White oaks are the best. Yep, and they're using the leaves too. Yep, and the low tannin white oaks. You're getting turkeys and deer and everything in there, right?
Absolutely.
Yep,
yes.
You bet. You got a good thing going there.
I have one other question. A local nursery suggested service berries or June berries, whatever you want to call them. What do you think of that?
Those are okay, but they're not very drought tolerant. Mm-hmm. Okay, this year the service berry and June berry just got hammered, absolutely hammered. In a normal year, you'd probably be fine with that. Absolutely.
Okay.
But the June berries and service berries, they were hurting units this year.
I know the birds like the service berries, but I do too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you want service berries, you got to get there before the birds.
It's tough.
You got to jump on it. Yeah. But in a normal year, that's a perfectly good choice too. And there's many other choices for you as well. Those are just some of the bigger, more readily available species you can work with.
Thanks for that call, Brian. You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson talking today with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery. We're talking with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, talking about what we can still be doing this year to get our soil and our landscape ready for next year's native garden, and also planning for that native garden over this winter. I think that planning for a garden is, well, actually, in some ways, it's more fun than actually gardening, because you don't get hot, sweaty, cold, dirty, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, doesn't hope just spring eternal with gardeners?
Absolutely. Yeah, and like you say, Judith, the design part is the inspiration, not the perspiration.
Exactly. And we will get to that. But I want to make sure first to let people know that on Monday at 11, Larry is back, and he's going to learn about the history of the Christmas tree ship. It sank 100 years ago yesterday, actually. And if you're interested in some events going on this weekend to commemorate it, they're up on our Facebook page, or you can go to the Rogers Street Fishing Village page. Rogers Street Fishing Village is in Two Rivers. That website is www.rogersstreet.com. So there are two S's in the middle, rogersstreet.com. And again, there's some activities going on this weekend around the centennial of the sinking of the Christmas tree ship. Norma Bishop from the Wisconsin Maritime Museum will be joining Larry on Monday at 11 to talk about that. It's really a fascinating piece of Wisconsin history. Then Monday at 11:45, it's time for the weather guys again. Last time they were on, it was just before Hurricane Sandy. So they were doing some predictions and trying to, you know, see what they thought was going to happen. Well, they're going to give us the post-storm analysis on Monday, talk about that, and they'll also give us a holiday season forecast for Wisconsin. So lots coming up on Monday. I hope you can tune in. Well, we are talking about prairies and woodlands and meadows with Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery. And Neil, let's go back to the phone and Robin in Portage. Hi, Robin.
Good morning, Judith and Neil.
Yes.
Hi, Robin.
Hi. Okay, Neil, my wildflower gardens didn't do so hot this summer with the drought because I couldn't water. I did lose a lot, but at this point, my question is this. This is my second fall. I planted 2 years ago, and I have tons of oak leaves in there that I haven't been able to get out, but maybe I shouldn't, but I'm concerned. I have not cut the flowers back yet to 6 inches. Are there any seeds left on those flowers? If they lay on the leaves, will they actually get down into the soil? Or do I need to get the leaves, the oak leaves, as you know, out of there?
How thick are the leaves there, Robin?
Couple
inches?
Pardon?
Couple inches, you think, or more?
No. Not even an inch.
Okay. You're okay with that. That's all right. If you had them piled up like 3, 4, 5, 6 inches, then they would present a problem for emergence of the plants the next spring, because oak leaves don't really degenerate very fast and break down. But if it's just an inch or so, you should be okay with that.
Okay. But what about the flower heads and stuff that I haven't cut back yet? Are they just going to lay on top of those seeds? Are they going to get under?
Yeah. You can just leave them up over winter if you want. You don't have to cut them now. And you can just let them sit there. The seeds will fall and work their way down through the leaves into the soil over the winter.
And birds will also eat some of the seeds, too.
Exactly. And I doubt, you said you lost some plants, or did they just go dormant?
Oh, they just died.
Are you sure?
Oh, I'm positive, because they just broke right off at the ground level.
Well, that doesn't mean they're dead. I'm going to bet you they're dormant. Have you done an autopsy?
Have I done an autopsy?
Yeah. Dig around the base of the plant.
Okay.
Okay. Get like a little knife or a little dandelion digger and just dig around the base of the plant and look for a bud at the top of the root and see if the roots are intact.
Roots did come up with the plant.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You know what? We'll have to take a look at it. Okay. We don't live too far away. I helped her with this.
Well, I know.
So.
Yeah.
So we'll take a look at it. But I'd be surprised if you lost a lot of plants, because they're pretty tough. And your soil is sandy, but it's not that bad.
All right. So. Well, good luck with that, Robin. And we'll be waiting for the autopsy results when Neil goes digging around out there. Jerry in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. I planted a no-mow lawn this year, and it was an absolute battle with the weeds, but we managed to win that battle, at least so far. It looks pretty good this fall. I'm wondering, do you recommend using a pre-emergent herbicide on that in the spring? If you do, what do you recommend, and when would I apply it?
All right.
Excellent question. And now you probably planted in the spring, is that right, Jerry?
Yeah,
that's when you get all the weeds. It's yeah. I'll tell you a little story. I plant in my house. You know, the shoemaker's children have no shoes. You know, that's my place. So, and I torture plants at my house to make sure that when you get to your house that they are really tough. So a few years ago, I put in a new garden, in a food garden, and I just wanted to put a little strip of no-mow around it. And I broke the rules. I planted it like in May or something stupid. You know.
Exactly what you tell other people not to do.
Of course not. But it's my house, so I can break the rules. Okay, and I'm going to see just what these plants can take. So the no-mow came up. It grew about an inch tall. And then the foxtail came up. And the foxtail grew waist high. I never mowed it. I did nothing. And I said, you know what? The no-mow's under there. It's an inch tall. It'll be fine. It's a perennial. The foxtail's an annual. It'll be fine next year. The next spring, like three foxtails came up. It was a solid, perfect no-mow lawn. Now, I'm not saying that's the case that you have there because it depends on the weeds you have. But, yeah, spring seedings always have weeds. What to do next spring to prevent weed germination? You have a couple different options as far as pre-emergence. A lot of people use the organic method of corn gluten. And somebody figured out that the gluten from the corn, the actual corn, when it's applied on the soil, will prevent the germination of seeds. And if your no-mow turf is well-established and you don't need to overseed it, and all you have to worry about are weeds coming up next spring, you can apply the corn gluten to prevent weed seed germination. And otherwise, you have the typical different pre-emergence, like, well, they have weed and feed. Normally, we don't put fertilizers on a no-mow lawn, except in really poor sandy soils. Then we do have to, rocky soils, sometimes we do have to fertilize it. But normally, all you need to do is just put down a pre-emergent. But these are, you know, chemical herbicides. A lot of people don't want to use them, so they do have the alternative of the corn gluten. Most of your pre-emergents are good for 2 to 3 months. And some of your weeds will germinate fairly soon in spring. So we recommend that you put down your corn gluten or your pre-emergent herbicide really pretty soon in spring, as soon as you can get out there and put it down. Now, the problem with that is that you'll prevent the cool season weeds from germinating. But by June, if you put it down in April, the pre-emergence is pretty much gone. So you'll have to reapply a second time, usually in late May, early June, because that's when your crabgrass starts to germinate and all those warm season annuals come
out. So kind of a booster shot.
Exactly. So you're going to do it once in probably early April and then once probably early June, and that'll keep you good for the whole year.
Great. Good luck with that, Jerry. And Neil, I want to make sure we talk a little bit. We have talked about preparing and maintaining an established native planting now and planning for that for the spring. And we've talked a little bit when one of the callers was saying that, you know, she's kind of wrestling with her neighbors about putting in a new native planting. What about folks for planning a native area? What about for folks that might have a lot of perennials now? Maybe some of them are native, but, you know, a lot of perennials, and they want to kind of make a little bit of a hybrid. One of the things I enjoy about talking with you is that you're not, you know, all one or the other. It's, you know,
I am not a plant Nazi.
You're not. Exactly. So what if someone wants to start planning now for incorporating some more native grasses, native flowers, maybe some woodland plants in a shadier area? What's the best way for them to get started?
You know, a lot of our customers do this. And, you know, I used to be a native plant fundamentalist, but I got hit on the struck by lightning on the road to Damascus. So I've since reformed
my
ways.
You've seen the light.
I've seen the light. And interestingly, and this is a deep, dark secret. I think I've actually mentioned this on this show once before, but I do actually have some hostas at my house. Yes. The deer ate them all this year because of the drought. So, you know, big deal. But they'll be back. But a lot of people mix our native wildflowers and some of our native grasses and sedges for the woodland with their hostas in their shade areas. Hmm. And it's really nice because, you know, the hostas don't really get going until June, July. That's when they really start to get their leaves up. We have all those early spring native wildflowers that give you that interest in April, May, and June before the hostas get going. And then a lot of the woodland plants go dormant because they're spring ephemerals. They just kind of disappear and the hostas take over. So they make really good companions for hostas if you have that kind of garden. Also, some people have sunny perennial gardens and, you know, plants come and go. They die. They don't live forever. And more people are putting in prairie plants as part of their perennial gardens. And it's really interesting. As I said earlier, I can design you an English garden using all native Wisconsin prairie plants. The English have been using our prairie plants for hundreds of years.
Interesting.
Because they were exotic, cool plants from the New World. Yeah. And so they've been using, you know, they were using purple coneflower while we were busy plowing it up. And butterfly weed and eupatoriums, and they've been using these plants in their gardens for eons. And you can do the same thing in your home. You can incorporate the native plants with some of your more traditional, you know, grandma's plants in the garden, or ones that are commonly used. And by just looking at different colors, textures, etc., you can create beautiful hybrid gardens as well.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I think often people, when they hear native plants, they think prairie plants and they think full sun. But I love woodland plants, and they're not as showy usually, but they're just, I love them.
They're showy in their own way.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, at my house, you know, I have prairies and I have woodlands, but there's this one plant that I use, and to get back to what do I do after I cut down the buckthorn and the honeysuckle in a shaded place, mm-hmm. I have these rocky hillsides. I mean, you want to talk about rock. It's just fractured dolomite, mm-hmm. and the rock is at the surface. And I cut all the buckthorn and honeysuckle out, and I put in wild ginger. And the flower is under the leaves, and when those leaves are there, they completely cover the flowers. It's the highest, most common part of my entire garden of this species.
Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery in Westfield on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Native plants add a lot of beauty and interest to a landscape, but besides that, they also create healthy habitat for all kinds of wildlife, too. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Neil DeBull from Prairie Nursery knows a lot about native and woodland plants and grasses. He always has great advice to share, whether you have just a few square feet or acres of prairie. Neil, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Judith. My pleasure.
And of course, we're just hearing on the NPR News that this is Black Friday and people are going crazy shopping. And of course, you know, we do an annual show talking about gifts for gardeners. We did that last week with Astrid Neuenhaus. Always lots of fun. But you had a couple ideas, too. Maybe a membership.
Okay, yeah. We offer gift certificates at Prairie Nursery, and you can get something special without knowing what
there
your special friend mm-hmm. gardener wants. If you know they're into native plants, we'd be more than happy to provide a gift certificate. Just call us up, and anything from $25 up to, you know, $10,000 or whatever, yeah, you know, whatever's convenient. Yeah. And that way they can pick out what they want. We send them a catalog with it. And actually we're having a sale. You get 10% off. So a $100 gift certificate only costs you $90. $51 only costs mm-hmm. $45. And then your friend gets the catalog, and then they can pick and get whatever they want.
And the catalog is great. I was just looking at it during the break. You do have so many. You make it pretty easy because it can be kind of overwhelming seeing so many different plants and, you know, for different areas. But you have thematic gardens like you were mentioning, you know, and for different sizes. It's scaled. So maybe you have a small area but you want to attract butterflies. You have a list of plants, but maybe you have a larger area or larger than that. You also talked about that, you know, it's nice to support some of the organizations that are really working on the environment. And a membership to one of those organizations gets people opportunities to go on field trips sometimes, or they get great newsletters with lots of information. And one of the groups that you really like is the Wild Ones.
Yes, it's a great organization, Judith. And it's a nonprofit, and it's based out of Appleton, Wisconsin. And it's really just a really cooperative group of people who are committed to restoring the environment, restoring the integrity of our native ecosystems, and creating wildlife habitat. And they have conferences. It's just a really good group. And an annual membership is only $37 a year. And you can get in touch with the Wild Ones at their website, www.wildones, that's WILDONES, wildones.org.
And they've been on the show before, and I know that they actually have a lot of great volunteer opportunities, too.
Oh, yes. And they have different local chapters, mm-hmm. and each chapter they'll have different activities, like a plant rescue. You can go and get free plants
right,
by just
right.
digging them up in a construction project. Sometimes they'll go out on seed collecting things. Sometimes they'll do like tours to nurseries. Mm-hmm. They come to our nursery mm-hmm. Every few years.
And I know they do wildlife or invasive eradication projects too. So lots of great, and certainly they're not the only group, but that was one that you were familiar with. And if other people have ideas for great gift ideas for gardeners like that, I also think when we talked with Astrid Neuenhaus, she talked about giving the gift of time. And so, you know, besides maybe providing a membership to something, saying, hey, you know, Aunt Judy, let's go on this field trip together, or, you know, something like that. Those are some really special ways to do something for the holidays. Well, Neil, not surprisingly, we have a lot of people that want to talk with you. Our phones are full right now, but they will probably open up in a little bit. The number is 800-642-1234. We will do our best to get through some of these calls, and we'll start with Joya in Fitchburg. Hi, Joya.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a few questions. I've been having this native flower garden for a while, about 5 years now. Neil, I have a question for Neil. Neil, because of the drought, some of the butterfly wheat plants, I think they died this year. I have not dug up the roots or anything. But will they come back next year?
Well, that's a good question, Joya. This is another thing when we were talking about the intensity of the drought. In the drought of 1988, which was really bad, a lot of people said it was the worst since 1934, the butterfly weed never skipped a beat. This year, I saw butterfly weed actually wilting and dropping its flowers, unprecedented in my lifetime of 58 years. So, however, the plants did recover when we got some rain. It's an extremely deep-rooted plant. They usually live 15 to 20 years. So it does have an expiration date. You don't get more than 20 years out of most butterfly weed, but that's pretty good for a perennial. So how long have your plants been in the ground, Joya?
About 3 years. I think I put it in 2010.
Okay. You know, what you can do is, like I said earlier, you can just dig around very carefully at the surface of the soil. Butterfly weed roots have a very distinctive white bud at the top of the root. And if you see a good, solid, firm root with white buds on it, then the plants are fine. If you see a bunch of, usually when the roots die, you'll see a blackening of the top of the root. That is not a good sign. However, I've seen butterfly weeds that have been eaten by, I don't know, moles or voles or whatever. They eat the top off the root, and the butterfly weed just sends new shoots up around the lower part of the root. So it's a pretty tough plant. So I wouldn't call it dead until you don't see it till next year. And remember, the butterfly weed is one of our last plants to come out of the ground in the spring. Sometimes it doesn't come out until June. So I would wait until July 4th to pronounce it dead.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Give it time. They sometimes, and if they did have root damage to the top of the root, which is not uncommon, then they have to generate new buds around the side, and they will not emerge from the soil until, really, literally until June, even early July. So give it time.
Okay. Also, another quick question is, I put some, old leaf mulch yesterday because of nice weather. And then do I have to put a hay on top of it also for the native garden?
Okay, and this is for a prairie garden or for a woodland garden?
Right. It's a small garden.
Okay, for a prairie or woodland?
No, prairie.
Okay, prairie. Yeah. Okay, how thick are the leaves that you put on it already?
Oh, they're about 3 to 4 inches. I already put on some of the young plants.
Okay, that's plenty. That's good. Okay, are these ones you put in this fall?
Or? Yeah, just yesterday. And I'm waiting for the wind to go away so I can put some hay on top of it.
Okay, but you just put the plants in now?
No, not the plants.
Oh, okay.
The mulch I put in.
Okay, yeah.
These are the plants from 2010, Joya?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, then 3 to 4 inches should be fine. You just shouldn't have to put any straw. And make sure when you're mulching your garden, don't use hay.
Don't use hay?
No, use straw. Straw is what is the remnants from harvesting wheat, oats, barley, rye. It tends to be low in weeds. Hay comes from like alfalfa fields and grass fields. It can be full of weeds, as I learned with my very first prairie planting.
Oh, dear.
Which my very first one, and I lived in this old farmhouse outside of Green Bay, and there was this hay sitting in the barn, and I asked the guy that owned the place, I was renting the place. I said, hey, are you going to use that hay? He said, I haven't used that hay for 20 years. You can have it. And I went and put it on my freshly seeded prairie, which I had painstakingly removed all the weeds before I put my seeds down. And oh my God, the weeds!
Dear.
And I had to go in with pruning shears and cut the weeds out at the bottom, at the base, on like 5,000 square feet. It took me days.
Oh wow!
Don't use hay.
Don't use hay.
Make sure you use straw.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Joya.
And good luck, Joya.
Yeah, best of luck with that. And Neil, you had just mentioned something about plants being eaten away and they still managed to come back. Sherry in Madison had called but couldn't stay on the line. She wanted to know if her prairie plants, which were eaten down 3 times by rabbits and deer this year, will come back next year.
That's a good question. When they are constantly removing the vegetation, it weakens the plants because they have to utilize their root reserves to replenish the leaves.
And especially this year, those reserves were already stressed.
Exactly. So 3 times, you'd probably be okay. But if it's continual and never ending, then you will eventually exhaust the roots and the plants will die.
Okay. But again, she doesn't say what kind of prairie plants, but yeah. Make sure you wait long enough to what did you say, to
pronounce them?
Pronounce them.
Yes. Yeah, give them time. Some plants come up fairly early in spring. Some plants come up later in spring, so you want to wait. And butterfly weed, of course, is one of the last ones that everybody's always freaking out. Where's my butterfly weed?
Right.
And it comes up in the middle of June.
All right. Nancy in La Crosse is next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm thankful for the show and for Neil. I learned so much from him. I have a strip of grass in the front of the yard, and we live in the woods, and it's clay. And I wanted to put my dream is either little blue stem or prairie drop seed, like a row of four or five, six. But they say full sun on them. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, are any of them, one or the other of those, better to use if they don't get full sun?
Okay,
I'm thinking like they maybe get 6 hours, and it's kind of a filtered because there's woods all around us.
Okay, let's do it rather than hours, because hours can change from 4 hours in December to 8 hours, 8 to 16 hours. Half a day of full sun is your minimum. Are you getting at least a half a day of full sun? Because that's what you need for the prairie grasses and most of your prairie flowers. Are you getting that? Of direct sun for half a day?
It would be marginal.
You said it was really more close. Filtered than direct also, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, as one of my first bosses said, Neil, you can solve a lot of landscape problems with a chainsaw, although that may not be an option in this case. You may want to keep those trees. If you don't have at least a half a day of full sun, I would not recommend growing little blue stem or prairie drop seed. And even if you did have the sun on this, Nancy, little blue stem does not do very well in clay. Prairie drop seed is much more clay tolerant. But it's very difficult to get little blue stem to grow from either transplants or from seeds on a really heavy clay soil. If you have a good loamy or sandy loam surface over the clay, then it's not such a big deal. But in really heavy clay, little blue stem struggles, where prairie drop seed is more amenable to that.
So you think prairie drop seed would be a good option for Nancy?
Not if she doesn't have a half a day of full sun.
Okay. So what might be some good options for less sun?
There are some woodland grasses you can look at. There's one. It's not exactly native to Wisconsin. It's called Northern Sea Oats. It's absolutely gorgeous. With the climate change we're experiencing, it used to be marginally hardy in southern Wisconsin. Well, now it seems to be pretty fully hardy. Northern Sea Oats, Chasmanthium latifolium, absolutely gorgeous grass. It grows in Illinois, Missouri, those areas. You also have some sedges, some of our native sedges, which are really cool. And we're offering some new ones. If we get our catalog for next spring, we're offering a bunch of new sedges as well. And sedges grow in wetlands and sun, wetlands and shade, dry sand. There's all different species. Hmm. I think in Wisconsin we have 118 different species of sedges.
Wow.
And they're grass-like plants, but there's quite a range of their opportunities for where they can grow. So,
and again, you can get that catalog or browse the website at prairienursery.com. It's a beautiful catalog. I just love looking through it.
So if you got a little more shade there, look at some of the sedges. But if it's plantain leaf sedge is a great one. It makes a great border. So check out some of those. But if you don't have a half a day of full sun, I wouldn't recommend the prairie grasses.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Hope that helps. And if you have any other calls, if anybody has more questions, please feel free to call us at the office. We're here to help you out.
Great. Thanks, Nancy. And actually, you just mentioned prairie drop seed. Elaine on Facebook said, I planted prairie drop seed about 14 years ago in a small prairie area. I have 5 plants. They don't seem to flower and seed very much, not like what I saw at Prairie Nursery. Why would this be?
Very simple. Prairie drop seed, in order to really flower, you need to burn it.
You've got to burn it.
And studies have shown, and my experience has shown, that there was a study done, 30, 40 years ago, of burned versus unburned prairie drop seed. And prairie drop seed that was burned had up to 25 times as many flower stalks as the unburned.
Wow.
So burning, a lot of your prairie plants really do better with burning management. Prairie drop seed is one that really almost requires it.
Interesting.
Isn't that really interesting?
Wow.
So to maximize our production on our prairie drop seed fields, we burn it every year.
There you go.
We would get 50% or 20% of the harvest if
we
didn't burn
it. So that explains it.
Yep.
Wow. All right. Well, Alan Abrams is next. Hi, Al.
Hello. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Big Al. How you doing?
Good. How you doing yourself?
I'm hanging in there, buddy. I'm ready for winter.
Yeah, I'm not. I've got a 20-plus-year-old, very dry, third of an acre prairie.
On that Abram sand of yours?
Yep, real fine sand, very little organic matter.
Yep.
It's not something I can burn. I've got it, a big little blue stem Indian switch, lupin, black-eyed Susan, yellow cone, white false indigo, lanceleaf coreopsis, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do to rejuvenate that? It seemed to be losing the flowers.
Yeah.
Flowering plants.
Okay, and you can't burn it?
Nope, I'm too close to the neighbor's, spruce plantation. I'd light up a 40 if I lit that on fire.
Can I come?
You bet. Just like the old days.
That's right, let's light up the 40. What you can do, and it's not as good as burning you, and I'm not sure if this is going to work for you exactly. As you see with a lot of times with prairie plantings, if you start, did you start with a fairly high percentage of grasses in there, Al? Or was
yes.
it? Yeah. And see, that's what happens is, and this is a really important point for folks out there that are thinking about doing a prairie. The seeds you put in the ground on day one are going to determine what that prairie looks like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. It's unbelievable. Well, I can only speak for 35 years of experience.
That's kind of terrifying, actually.
But the point is that if you start with a high grass to forb ratio, you're going to end up with a high grass to forb ratio. If you start with a high flower to grass ratio, you're going to end up with a high flower to grass ratio because it's all about who gets in there and gets established.
Establishes themselves.
And then they start reproducing, and now you have the percentage of seeds that are produced. If you have a higher percentage of flower seeds produced to grass, then you're going to have more flowers. So it's really, in your situation, it's going to be tough. And even with burning, that doesn't guarantee you will be able to improve the performance, perhaps, of individual plants that you have in there, but not necessarily change the balance. Now, better living through chemistry, you could go in there, and you remember from Keith White's Vegetation of Wisconsin, Vegetation Management? Did you take that course, Al?
Oh, yes.
I think you were in there. Yeah, we were in there together. Okay. Yep. Better living through chemistry, you can go in there with herbicides and knock out some of your grasses or at least set them back. There are grass-specific herbicides such as Post or Fusilade that you can use, and it won't necessarily kill the grasses, but you can put a world of hurt on them, thus giving the prairie flowers an advantage. Also, on your dry, sandy soil, do you have open patches of sand in there, Al?
Several, yes.
Okay, what you can do is you can go in there and just get one of those, like, those little three-prong rakey things, and scratch the ground in the fall. This is the best time to do it. You can overseed into dry sand in the fall. Just scratch the ground up and throw your forb seed in there, and that will give you an opportunity to...
And forb is what?
Oh, excuse me. Forbs are the same as flowers. Thank
okay.
you, Judith. Yes. Flower seed. Let's keep it similar. And scratch your flower seeds in the fall, and a lot of your flower seeds do have dormancies that are broken by spending the winter in the soil, so you'll get better germination than if you planted them in the spring. So that's what I would do if I were yours. I would go in there and add flower seeds to the open areas of sand.
There you go.
And that will increase your forb to grass ratio.
Great.
And when you're ready to light up that 40, let me know.
Hey, anytime, Neil.
Okay, good talking to you, Al.
Okay, take a look. Bye.
Thanks, Al. And let's go to Jim in Poinette next. Hi, Jim.
Howdy do. Question about no-mo. I planted my no-mo in middle of September, germinated somewhere around the first part of October, and when we get those first rains, wondering when I can stop watering it. Obviously, the hoses are getting a bit of
oh,
a problem.
Yeah. You can stop watering it 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay, I did about a week ago. Actually.
Yeah, yeah. When the hoses freeze up, that's the time to stop watering it. No, you're good to go, and what happens here is you get into the latter part of fall, the water stress on those plants is greatly reduced. So generally, we will only water it for the first, 4 to 6 weeks, depending, sometimes less than that, depending on the weather. So you're good to go now.
Okay.
Okay, it's probably about 2 inches tall now. Is that right, Jim?
About 2 inches tall, and the roots are down about 3 inches. Yeah.
Good. You should be good to go for the winter, barring in a catastrophic winter. But that's pretty
and
darn good establishment. Yeah.
And is there anything that Jim needs to do to protect that newly seeded no-mo?
Nope. It should be ready to go. And really, it should be. It looks sounds like it's doing well, and you should be ready for it to take off next spring. And a nice thing about planting in the fall, you probably have almost no weeds in there. Is that right, Jim?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. There's just a couple of broadleaves coming through. And
yep.
And a couple of stray grasses here and there, which
okay.
I plucked.
Yeah. So compared to a spring planting, you have very few weeds. And then next spring, that no-mo is going to start growing right out of the box after winter, and it's going to shut the whole thing down. You'll probably just have the few weeds that came up this fall, maybe a few more that show up next spring.
Great. Well, good luck with that, Jim, and you can pack that hose away. And Laura in Fort Atkinson has a comment for us. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have to tell you what I did. I live on a rocky, sandy ridge with a lot of oak trees in it. And I had very few wildflowers in it, anemones and wild geraniums and poison ivy. And that was it. But my neighbors had a similar ridge, and it was carpeted every spring with Dutchman's breeches and bloodroots. And so I begged them if I could go over and dig up just a few. So I dug up one bloodroot and five stems of Dutchman's breeches. I brought them home, and this is about 15, 20 years ago, and now my woods is carpeted. I have thousands of each of them.
Wow.
Wow, I am jealous.
Oh, it's just beautiful.
That must be incredible.
We would love to see a picture of that, Laura.
Well, I'm electronically challenged. I don't have an eye system, but I could send you one in the mail.
That would be lovely. You can just send that to Garden Talk at Wisconsin Public Radio, and we would love to see that.
Okay, will do.
Well, congratulations on your fabulous gardening efforts. That sounds absolutely beautiful.
Doesn't that sound beautiful?
Yeah.
Well, Neil, in just the last couple of minutes here, one of the things that people can be doing right now is if they collected prairie seed, they can be cleaning it and getting it ready for next year. What does that mean exactly?
Well, a lot of our customers like to go out, if they've already got an established prairie, they will go out and collect some of the seeds. This was not a very good year for it because of the drought. But some plants did fine. A lot of them didn't do anything. They just didn't make any seeds.
They did minimal effort.
And even some seeds that were produced may not be viable because they didn't have sufficient energy to complete the seed formation process. But if you do collect your own seeds, now's the time of year when you can clean them. And you don't have to have fancy, special equipment to do this. In fact, when I first went into business, I had a bunch of screens. You take 1x4s and you make a 2x2 foot square or whatever size you want to do. Mm-hmm. We were doing fairly large quantities. Mm-hmm. And you just put different size screens, staple screens on all the way around the frame. And then you take little strips of wood that are 3/4 inch wide to cover the screen stapled part on the frame so you don't rip your hands apart. And then you put your seeds, all the heads and everything you collected, and you wear leather gloves and you just rub them through the screens to break the seeds out. And then you can take all that material and you put it in a 5-gallon pail, and then you take a vacuum cleaner that you can put on one of those canister-type vacuum cleaners you can put on reverse or a shop vac, okay? And then you take it outside. Do not attempt this inside. Take it outside. You're probably going to do this out in the garage or the shed because it's really dusty.
Yeah.
Okay. Wear a mask. You want to make sure you wear a mask. And then you take fill the 5-gallon pail maybe with 6 to 8 inches of this material that you run through the screen. And it depends upon the seed species. It has to be a heavy seed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then you go outside with the vacuum cleaner on reverse and a little blower. You know, you put the little so it's on
extension thing.
Yeah. So it just shoots out the hole. You don't have any
not a brush or anything.
No attachments, right? And you carefully angle it into the 5-gallon pail, and it blows all the chaff off, leaving the seeds in
seeds.
The bottom. But you got to be careful; you don't push it too hard or get it too close. Then all the seed blows out too.
Right.
So it's a really simple way to clean your seed.
Great.
Without expensive equipment.
All right. Well, Neil DeBull of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, it's always a pleasure having him on to tell us about native plants. Neil, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
And you've been listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Have a great rest of the day.